Good morning and welcome to Backchat this half hour with James Ockenden and me, Jim Gould. And for the next 30 minutes, we're going to be concentrating on the Financial Secretary's budget delivered yesterday. A number of talking points, of course, $10,000 electronic vouchers for all permanent residents and new arrivals, a change in the first-time mortgage arrangement, up to 90% mortgages for on properties worth up to $10 million, as opposed to $8 million at the moment. Various things, tax breaks for people renting their apartments, protection for SMEs who get into trouble and can't pay their rent on time, reform of the domestic rating system. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about all these elements. We're joined now in our Admiralty studio by David Webb, shareholder activist and founder and editor of website.com, and also on the line, Vera Yoon, a lecturer at the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Hong Kong. David Webb first, perhaps if we could ask you about the Financial Secretary's growth forecast of the year, between 2 and 3.5%. What do you think of that? Is that overly optimistic or what?
That's finger-in-the-air stuff. It depends how long the current madness continues in terms of locking down the economy and preventing people going about their business. We'll have to wait and see about that. And what I like to do with the budget, I've been on your show nearly every year since 2006 talking about the budget. So what I do is look at the occurrence of buzzwords in it to indicate the direction. The word tech is the most popular word in the budget. It's 87 times, followed by green 49 times, and subsidies or subsidy 36 times, and innovation 32 times, closely linked to tech, and I&T 25 times. There's a lot of central planning, government knows best in there. For example, they've announced that they're going to ask the science park and the cyberport to pick some winners by investing some of the reserves in a so-called Hong Kong growth portfolio tech fund.
That's $5 billion, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's just diverting part of our resources into that. Rather than letting the free market finance good ideas, the government knows best how to do that. Surprisingly few references to Metropolis, only five of those, and Motherland four times, perhaps not quite being patriotic enough there. Lantau Tomorrow four times, falling behind Metropolis. That's last year's idea, and this year's idea is Metropolis. I think they might be sanctioned for not mentioning Belt and Road enough. There's only two of those, and dual circulation two times. So that's the flavour of the budget. Isn't it amazing that they can suddenly find the wherewithal to build accommodation for 10,000 households in isolation in the space of a month, when for years they've had trouble finding homes for subdivided apartments, some of which people in subdivided apartments are owned by wives of senior officials. Now suddenly they can find, you know, not just 10,000 on Penny's Bay, but then there's going to be another huge number on unknown number on the Lochmarchow Loop and various other sites. Suddenly we can provide a separate accommodation for everybody when we put our minds to it. The huge amount of money that's being spent on that for a problem that is going to be largely over by the time they're ready. The Omicron wave, if you look at all of the international precedents from South Africa to the UK and onwards, it's going to be a very short, sharp shock to Hong Kong's health system. And then it will decay rapidly in the space of the next 2 months, even if the government does nothing, because the vaccination rate is already very high amongst the population, except for a very small cohort above the age of 80. And even them, even the 80s are now 45% first-time vaccinated. They've suddenly got off of their rocking chairs and wheelchairs and got the jab quite rapidly in the last month. And in 2 months' time, that figure will be closer to 70%. It just takes them that interval to get the second jab in and the first jab for some of them. So, you know, the only reason for that kind of profligate spending on isolation facilities, there's $20 billion set aside for that, what the unstated goal here is not to protect the elderly, it's to get back down to COVID zero and reopen the mainland border and join the mainland never-ending COVID bubble, which prevents mainland citizens from travelling outside of the intranet and experiencing the outside world and so on. There's a political tint to all of that. That must be the logical inference. Otherwise, the whole thing is illogical. You wouldn't do all of this just to purportedly prevent a few thousand or delay a few thousand deaths. Even Hong Kong U and its dire forecasting says that by mid-May, 3,000 people will likely have died from COVID. But 90% of those, based on latest data, will be unvaccinated, mostly by choice. So we're talking only about a few hundred people who, without their choice, even with vaccination, will have died. And in a normal year, 50,000 people die. So the quota up to May would be around 23,000 people would normally die in that period. It's only an excess death rate of about 15%. You know, so all this money is being piled into basically an objective of getting us down to zero again through very draconian interventions, shutting down businesses and spending money to compensate people for that. And then if you look at the broader scope of the budget, all sorts of opportunities missed again to make the tax system flatter and fairer. Instead, they're escalating it. There's a money grab on people who have larger residential properties coming up, although he's deferred it till after the current administration.
You're talking about the rates reform?
Rates reform will go up till, but not until 2024-5, I believe. But so the next government could change their minds on that. You know, we've had a nice simple system, 5% of rateable value across the board for decades. And that's a fair system. There's nothing fair about escalating the rate in a sort of envy tax, a populist move. They're not talking about doing that on large office properties or hotels or retail outlets, only on residential properties. Also taking, fiddling with other parts of the system as well. They should stop doing rates rebates instead of they're now talking about continuing with those one-offs indefinitely, but only if they're owned by a natural person and only one property each. And then they say, but it will take us time to update our information technology systems at the RVD, the Rating Evaluation Department. Well, I could have done that for them in an afternoon. It's a few lines of code and an extra field in the database for the ID number of the property owner, so you can make sure they only have one property in their name.
Okay.
But anyway, it's there's a lot of intervention in there, a lot of taxpayers' money being put into centrally planned innovation. That has to be paid for. He said, we won't raise profits tax this time. We won't raise salaries tax this time. But there's talk, there's an inference from the last few statements in the budget about sooner or later they're going to have to do that. And escalating the rates is the first step. Last year they grabbed on stamp duty, raised it 30%, and first registration tax. We already have an envy tax on luxury cars. We don't just charge a flat rate. We charge 130% on a Ferrari and a much lower percentage on a Toyota, Corolla.
Okay. So I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we also have Vera Yoon with us from the Faculty of Business and Economics at Hong Kong U. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm very happy to listen to David.
Good morning, Vera.
We all are, but we only have half an hour, so...
Yeah, we used to have 54 minutes, now
Well, as you know, the first half of Backchat is now devoted to COVID update, so... anyway, Vera Yoon, in terms of the contents of the budget, what were the highlights for you?
Well, you just asked about the economic forecast, whether that 3.5% is appropriate. I think it's too high because the IMF Article 4 Mission Concluding Statement for Hong Kong, published on the 20th of January, housing growth estimate for 2022 of 3%, and that was before the exploding increase in number of infections in the fifth wave. So that 3% has not accounted for what has happened in Hong Kong in these 2 months. So with these all like tightening of social distancing measures, closing of retail stores and restaurants, consumption is going to contract substantially except for grocery stores. And then investors, they would be very reluctant to the investment. In fact, they would be receding to invest because it's just too uncertain. You don't know when you can open again. So basically, the first half of the 2022 has been completely destroyed, and you only have the second half to make it up. So I expect the growth to be substantially lower than 3% as predicted by IMF, and that depending on the development of the pandemic, we may have a sharp rebound in second half of the year, but still big downside risk. So it's hard to achieve what Paul Chan has stated, that, you know, 3.5%. I think the range is like 2 to 3.5%. I would go for the lower part.
He must be assuming COVID zero by June, which, you know, has all sorts of assumptions about success on driving this down and isolating hundreds of thousands of people, using hundreds of thousands of other people to control them, and so on. It's just mind-boggling how they think they can do that, and what is the point? Whereas you look at places like Singapore, they've moved on. They've had their exit wave already with Omicron, and vast majority of people have mild symptoms, as the government here admits. I mean, Carrie Lam in her speech the other day said there were only 49 serious and critical people in hospital at that time. That's true. And in the same breath said, well, we must fight the virus, we must get it down, pursue dynamic zero. Mm. The incoherency of that speech was breathtaking. Mm.
David, let me ask you about this envy tax you're talking about, because I mean, you've in the past said that people in public housing, in large public housing, like elderly, should perhaps move into smaller public housing to make way for families and things like this. Isn't that just another form of envy tax, but a sort of more public way? I mean, what's the problem with taxing the richer more?
And I think those are two different issues. What I've said about public housing is that we should support the needs of those who can't afford housing by providing public rental vouchers, not requiring them to live in government-owned properties, but giving them a free choice by giving them the equivalent subsidy that they're getting indirectly by paying a very discounted rent, instead saying, here's the top-up voucher per capita. And that means that when your children leave home and apply for their own voucher, then your voucher reduces. If you want to stay in that home, you're either going to have to pay for the extra money yourself or find a smaller unit. And the government doesn't need to own all of that housing stock. At that point, then you have a much more efficient allocation system, because what's been happening over decades now is that the number of people per household in public housing and generally has been dropping. And we've got empty bedrooms as children grow up, or as divorces happen. As fast as we build the new units, we're only accommodating on average an extra one person per unit across the public housing stock. And also we force all the poor people who need public support to live in the same areas. And the result of that is sort of ghettoisation, where you have children of poor people going to the same school, not mixing with other income groups. So it's a less equal society. And instead, if people had the portability of a voucher, they could go where their job takes them. If they lose a cleaning job or a security guard job in Tin Shui Wai and they get one in Aberdeen, they don't have to go halfway across all the way across the territory with a public transport subsidy. They can simply find a unit in Aberdeen of comparable rental value and use the voucher for that. So that it's about being more efficient with limited resources and not tying up government capital in the ownership of these properties. Those could all be sold off into the private sector and still people would get the support they need.
Varyun, one of the, if you like, headline measures announced in the budget was the $10,000 in electronic vouchers for all adult permanent residents and new arrivals. Regina Epp, the executive councillor, was saying that she thought it would have been better to give out $10,000 in cash. What do you think?
Yeah, I think cash is better. In terms of the effect to stimulate the economy, it would not be substantial, given the amount is like to middle class and the top income classes, that would not change the consumption behavior too much. So there's a little bit of income effect, but it's the substance. So the form is the choice between electronic vouchers and cash. So despite of the form, there will be a little income effect. And then this substitution effect with this handout that we would spend on durables earlier and then spend less in later time period, that is one of the substitution effects. The other one is that it would substitute our existing consumption with the vouchers. So with the account of the substitution effect, overall it does not stimulate the economy a lot. And then the vouchers is an inferior currency to cash, because vouchers have limitation on when they have to spend, where you can spend, etc.
Well, they're not that restrictive, Vera.
You
can put it on your octopus card, an octopus card,
time limit for you to finish using your first 5,000, whatever.
Sure,
but kind of limit, it makes it not a currency. Without the limit, that could be a good currency.
It's almost cash because the amount that people spend on basic living food each month, and you have 6 months or so to spend this money, is more than that.
He didn't talk about the time limit yet.
And then
because it's given out in April and he said the second wave will be given out in the summer, I suspect maybe 3 to 4 months, not half a year. And then there's another problem. If you give out the vouchers, and then last time what happened is people go to shopping mall everywhere, try to spend their money, and it's very crowded. And it's anti-pandemic measure.
I think
it is not aligning with the government overall direction of combating the pandemic.
No, because you see the Omicron will have burnt itself out by April, so that's when the first voucher appears, the first 5,000.
How can he be so sure?
By looking at the science. You know, science is quite good in this area. That's why they're saying April for that. And what people do is put the money on the octopus card and then save the money that they would have spent on groceries. That stays in the bank while they buy their daily needs on the octopus card.
There's substitution effect. It doesn't
dramatically boost consumption for that simple reason. I mean, that's what our household did. My wife and I, we have octopus cards, and we got the grocery shopping and put a bit less money onto the octopus than we normally would, because we normally use octopus anyway for a lot of the shopping.
If that's the case, why don't we just get cash?
It might be simpler, yes. I agree with you, it would be simpler.
There's a hidden agenda to engage retailers to install those machines for
encourage.
And I thought that was over, but then he said, he's going to include more this kind of electronic payment forms in. That's what's behind it.
I mean, contactless payment is not a bad thing, but I think we've probably got the value out of that the first time round, because anyone who's going to install a reader will have already done so in the wet markets or grocery markets and so on.
What about linking this to vaccination? Some people have said the vouchers should be linked to vaccination for elderly. Do you think that's a good
idea?
Yes,
well, they didn't do that the first time. They're not doing it this time either. It's amazing. If you want, you know, they could have provided all sorts of incentives along the way instead of leaving this problem for 2 years to fester. They could have introduced the vaccine pass earlier. They could have linked all the incentives, all the cash handouts to vaccination. They could have even looked at non-means tested benefits, you know, the extra money that you don't have to be poor to collect, like the over 70s fruit money. I mean, there are lots of wealthy people collecting that. Why don't we require everyone to be vaccinated before they can collect their fruit money? Anyone who's not, you defer it. You don't not pay it, but you say you're not having it until you're vaccinated. They could have done that when the vaccines became available over a year ago, and they didn't. And it was almost like saving up the elderly as an excuse for not opening the international border and saying, well, we can't because we're not sufficiently vaccinated. And then suddenly, because of the government policy on a 21-day quarantine, there's a cross-infection 2 days before somebody leaves their 21 days, and the result is this huge Omicron outbreak. Which apparently had not been war-gamed. You know, the officials are making up their plans as they go along. They didn't reach for the contingency plan number 123 or whatever, which says, if there's a huge Omicron outbreak, what are you going to do? Suddenly they're making it up as they go along, and the lack of contingency planning would shame anybody who works for a large organisation who has a disaster recovery plan for their business. The government is the biggest business in Hong Kong and doesn't have one at all.
OK. I'd like to ask you both about the property market, because one of the measures that Paul Chan announced was to make it easier for buyers to obtain mortgages for slightly more expensive flats. So first-time buyers will be able to take out a 90% loan for flats worth up to 10 million in the future, 2 million more than at present. Paul Chan was asked about that yesterday. He didn't think it would have any sort of much of an effect on the property market. He said he was doing it to meet the needs and the wants of Hong Kong people. And at the same time, the other measures introduced to stabilise the market in recent years, the special stamp duties, etc., all those would remain in place. So do you see any implications for the property market with that move, Vera Yoon, first?
I would say it will boost some segments of the housing market. And if you look at the income range that can actually buy these kind of flats, would be about $70,000 per month. So it's actually helping the kind of middle-class people to climb up the housing ladder. And the other explanation would be, 3 years ago, it was quite difficult to get 90% loan for some of the newly developed properties. So the developers, they give out loans with their own financial institution. And then those loans, they are now due, and they have to be remortgaged with banks and et cetera. And then so these is to help those people who cannot get a good remortgaging if they don't have good credit rating.
Mm-hmm. David?
Why do we still have a government-owned mortgage corporation? I mean, this is just an embarrassment in a free market. There is already the free market potential for mortgage insurance for those who want to take out larger than normal mortgages. Why doesn't the government focus on regulating the loan-to-value ratio and leave it at that? The Federal Reserve in the US is going to be raising rates this year. Hong Kong will have to follow that. The cost of servicing a mortgage will go up. So the last people into this system may be the ones that get stung by that, because they won't be able to pay their afford the mortgage they've taken out with this larger allowance and smaller deposit. So they may risk losing their homes if they can't keep up the payments. It would be better if we took away the mortgage corporation, put it into a run-off mode and sold off its loan portfolio or its insurance portfolio. And the same with other government quangos like the Export Credit Insurance Corporation. There is a commercial market for export in credit insurance. Why is the government still in that business? Rather than continue with fiddling with government interventions in the property sector. One of the things that the FS sort of crowed about yesterday was how we have an accidental surplus last year, even though he predicted a $100 billion or so deficit. It all comes down to a couple of huge land sales, including the central site. Three, I think it's not called, $50 billion sold to Henderson Land.
Right.
Done. So suddenly we have this big surplus, which he's spending several times over, because that's less than the $66 billion handout consumption vouchers.
And we've got the land sale program being announced today, actually. So, I mean, what do you expect out of that?
I come back to proposals I made years ago, more than a decade ago, on land lease reform. We need to be thinking ahead and producing a lower barrier to entry by having higher ground rents, which is currently 3% of rateable value for 50 years. Instead, why not make that 30% to build up a sustainable income stream for the government and lower the amount that developers are paying for in premiums? Because there's an offset between those two, you know, the cost of ongoing ground rents to the government that the eventual end user would pay mean that the premium is going to be lower, the price they pay for the unit would be lower, but you don't have the risk of a landlord coming in and kicking you out of your property because you're still the end user, you're still the owner of the head lease. And that way we wouldn't have such a lumpy revenue stream and instead would build up a longer stream for new leases. And of course there's a huge rollover of leases coming up in 2047 in anywhere north of Boundary Street in the New Territories. All of the leases expire unless they were granted between 1985 or after 1985, and then those progressively start to expire 50 years. It's not too late to impose this kind of structure on the renewals, because there's no right of renewal in those leases. But the closer we get to 2047, the more impossible it will be politically to suddenly say that renewal on your property, you're going to have to pay a much higher ground rent.
Absolutely. That's an issue that we'll be returning to, no doubt. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us on the programme. David Webb there, shareholder, activist and founder and editor of website.com, and Vera Yoon, lecturer at the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Hong Kong. A couple of emails just before we say goodbye for this morning, and just before we go to the news summary and morning brew. So this one from Simon says, Fitch, that's Fitch Ratings, already downgraded Hong Kong's GDP to less than 2% for 2022, the lowest of the 122 countries they follow. If this lockdown continues, we should expect mass unemployment and many businesses to go to the wall. I guess we will go negative, and that probably hasn't happened since 2003. It's a disaster, and the government should be held accountable for this disaster. And Richard writes, at what point do we cross the line where the constant closure of SMEs and the like will do more damage and distress to people's lives than what COVID is doing? Thank you to our listeners. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Sorry, I didn't get time to read them all out. We'll try and read them tomorrow, including an email from Andrew about school closures. And a quick look at the weather. Oh, thanks very much, of course, to our co-host this morning, James Ockenden.
Thanks, James. I want to hear about school closures too.
Right, okay. Well, that'll be one of tomorrow's topics on Backchat. And Janice Wong and Andrew Work will be with you. Slightly different time tomorrow, after 9 o'clock. In fact, it won't be Backchat. It'll be COVID update tomorrow, because from 8 till 9 tomorrow morning, the Financial Secretary, Paul Chan, will be here in person, and you can put your thoughts to Paul Chan in our special phone-in programme. That's at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. For the details, you can have a look at our website. The weather is going to be cold, certainly for the rest of this morning. Top temperatures, though, around 17 degrees later, and the outlook will be for, remaining cold tomorrow and sunny intervals early to midweek next week. It's currently 12 degrees, humidity is 70%, and the cold weather warning remains in effect.